Hi, this is Craig, CCL volunteer in Wisconsin. I've had the pleasure of meeting Tom a couple of times in conferences in the past year. So Tom Driscoll with the National Farmers Union. He is the Director of Conservation Policy, where he represents National Farmers Union members' interests in energy, climate, and environmental issues. Tom is also the Director of the National Farmers Union Foundation, which works to ensure that family farmers, beginning farmers, and youth in the organization have the educational resources they need to succeed through market and environmental change. Tom also oversees the online community called the National Farmers Union Climate Leaders. He is frequently the author in the regular climate column, which I encourage you all to look up on the National Farmers Union website and follow. His latest article was about one of my favorite foods, lentils. Before his time with the Farmers Union, Tom has worked a variety of jobs, including working with the EPA, with Congressman Tim Ryan, with a government relations firm, helping nonprofits apply for U.S. Department of Agriculture grants, writing articles for AgriPulse and other news, ag news services. Tom grew up in a rural community in Northeast Ohio. He's a licensed attorney in the states of New York and in Washington, DC. And I learned from his bio that he and his wife, Brittany, enjoy something that I share an interest of, which is riding our bikes on the annual ride across Iowa. So I welcome you to this webinar on connecting with farmers and climate, and pass it off to Tom.
Well, thank you for the kind remarks, the introduction, and the invitation to speak with you all. As Craig illuminated to some length, I get to work with farmers on climate change. I think that in explaining that work to you and hopefully offering you beneficial guidance on how to approach farmers on your climate work, the first point that I should probably make is that farmers are not monolithic. Farmers are as varied in their thoughts, approaches, and actions regarding climate change as the general population. But for purposes of our discussion today, I think I'll break it down into two rough categories. There's going to be folks you're able to talk to about climate change, and we'll get to them a little later because there's more conversation to be had there. And then there's folks who are farming, who you're just going to have to meet them where they are, who don't want to talk about climate change as an ongoing phenomena that has anthropogenic causes. And they are just going to have to be encouraged to take climate smart action on other terms. So one of the major aspects of climate communications that I've found is very important with farmers, particularly those who do not really want to acknowledge climate change as interconnected problem that we have to address altogether, is to focus on local conditions, focus on observable changes in their communities and on their farms. To address this, one of the major themes that we focus on in our climate education with NFU is why do farmers care about climate change? What are the particular phenomena? What are the particular changes that are being driven by climate change that are going to affect their business, their profitability, their livelihood, their communities? So you'll want to really be versed in what climate change does in the terms that matter to farmers. So you've got rising temperature, That causes heat stress on crops. That can damage yields. Some farmers might not really want to acknowledge that climate change is happening, but it's pretty irrefutable to as closely as farmers do that we're experiencing an extended trend in rising temperatures. And that has an impact on it causes crops and livestock to be more stressed, and it interferes with yield. In order to address that, you know, we can encourage farmers to take climate smart action, whether or not they want to call it climate smart action. You can encourage them to take beneficial endeavors that will help mitigate and adapt to climate change, and just coach it in terms of something that will protect yields and protect their livestock rather than talking about climate change. Extreme precipitation is a really big factor that folks across the board recognize. I have talked extensively about this matter to really traditional, really politically conservative farmers who really don't want anything to do with climate change. I have yet to meet a farmer who will deny that it rains less frequently but harder than it did when he or she was growing up, than when his or her parents were farming. And there's a lot of soil health practices that are really beneficial to the climate and really protect the food system from interference with climate change that are designed to, or not designed, but rather help farmers cope with extreme precipitation. Regardless of why a farmer undertakes these efforts, we will all benefit from that. Whether it be actually storing additional carbon in the soil through soil health practices, or folks who will benefit downstream from flood control that occurs upstream when farmers try to address extreme precipitation on their ground. On the flip, you have drought. There's a lot that farmers can do, particularly livestock producers who have animals that forage on pasture. There's a lot they can do to protect their business against drought. And it also has, protects the farmer's business, protects the farmer's profitability, but we will all benefit because they're storing carbon in the soil through undertaking those soil health practices that protect their pasture in times of drought. Wildfire, a very salient point right now. Climate change makes wildfire more likely and more extreme. Farmers are very, very sensitive to wildfire. They mobilize and look after each other when this happens. We had really bad fires in Kansas and Texas recently. A lot of our farmers in Oklahoma were, taking videos of loading hay onto the company trucks and sending it in, to those ranchers who are affected by fire. So everyone is very tuned in with that. That's a topic that's happening now. And highlighting that, stressing that it's costly and that it's very disruptive to the food system is a good way to connect with some farmers on climate change adaptation. Pest and weed pressure also changes as the climate changes. We see the USDA hardiness zones are steadily moving north, as well as the attendant pest and disease pressure. And there are climate smart actions that we can encourage farmers to take on that front as well. You've got integrated pest management that reduces really greenhouse gas intensive inputs that folks are putting on their crops, as well as reducing passes through the field to deal with disease and pest pressure that, you know, takes diesel fuel, or in the case of crop dusting, jet fuel to kind of treat their crops properly. In some cases, rising sea levels will affect farmers. Coastal farmers, California farmers, really rely on groundwater that rising sea levels, you know, we think about land being overtaken by the ocean, but a lot of wells, a lot of groundwater resources will be taken over by ocean water infiltration as the sea level rises. And that is a more direct impact to producers in a lot of cases than that loss of land. So that's a good thing to stress. You know, we want producers to conserve water so they're not as dependent on groundwater supplies, and that will encourage food system resilience to climate change. And then a lot of the waste management and food waste that farmers have to deal with on the farm, that's also compromised by climate change. Large-scale livestock producers have a lot of manure around that they have to manage, and that gets harder in floods and extreme precipitation. So having folks be aware of how precipitation is changing, and encouraging them to build nutrient management systems that accommodate that will do a lot to protect communities, surface water supplies, things of that nature, protect against contamination when a manure lagoon is flooded from a 100-year flood that's now happening every 20 years instead, things of that nature. So those are the direct kind of the salient points on why farmers really care about climate change. It just translating the impacts of climate change and the changes that we anticipate into terms that matter on the farm, discussing that and knowing, aside from planning, what practices farmers can take to address them, that will help you connect with folks who just don't want to hear about climate change, but that we're not going to be able to do the right thing for the food system without their participation. I'll move on to some topics that we can We'll move on to the farmers that are more active on this point now. One of the major things you'll be able to do is rely on their kind of civic-mindedness. Farmers tend to be engaged in their communities. In D.C., there's a certain political weight to farmers that I imagine is reflected in the countryside as well. And they're, you know, they're business people in their communities. So if you've got a farmer who's really attentive to climate change and is really active on this, they're going to be interested in making, infrastructure, zoning, transportation infrastructure decisions that are climate resilient. Connecting with them is a benefit to, you know, climate smart planning in rural communities. You've also got a lot of farmers interested in climate change. And if this is presented properly to farmers who aren't as active on climate change, this is beneficial as well. There's a lot that farmers can do to turn a profit, but benefit the climate in the meantime. Craig mentioned the blog post I wrote on lentils earlier. Farmers are under a lot of pressure to produce just a small number of crop species, and that is not good for soil health. We have the opportunity to store a lot of carbon in the soil if we have good soil health practices, as well as achieve all the drought and flood resilience that we would prefer to achieve when we have wider crop rotations and farmers grow a greater variety of crops. They just don't have the opportunity to market those crops as extensively as we would like. So they're under a lot of pressure to stick as closely to a corn bean rotation or a corn bean alfalfa rotation rather than work pulse crops or legumes or oats or what have you into the mix. So if we pursue government policies and marketing opportunities for those additional crops, that would give market signals to farmers to act in a climate smart way. Union of Concerned Scientists recently issued a study on the soil health quality improvements that would be achieved through greater planting of oats in Iowa. There's kind of a nearby and ready market. If equine interest people kind of got together and decided that they were ready to incorporate more oats into their horse feed, we would see a market signal to start planting more oats. On the other hand, you could have government policies like NRCS conservation support to get producers to plant more oats, and eventually, hopefully, an entrepreneurial company would realize that there were a lot of cheap oats around that were standing up for conservation reasons and figure out a way to make use of those oats, grow that market. Same would be true for lentils or field peas, any number of other crops that we have seen not exactly disappear from the landscape, but certainly are not being deployed as readily as they used to be. Another really good example of that is the livestock practices, the intensively managed grazing that is really great for the soil, really deep root systems with perennial grass that encourages microbial life deep down in the soil, kind of makes it a very absorbent sponge that helps the grass remain vibrant when there's a drought, but also helps the soil incorporate a lot of water when there's a really significant rain event. There's the scale of livestock, the scale of like beef production on ground like that does not get you into the really big meat processing plants that most of the food system is serviced by. And it's very hard for a smaller livestock processing facility to get USDA inspection, which is a barrier to access to grocery stores. So if we pursue government policies that make it easier for smaller scale livestock processing to exist and be profitable, more farmers will be able to conduct intensively managed grazing, which has a lot of soil health benefits, as well as just kind of reduces reliance on feed that may have traveled a long way and may have been produced in input intensive manner that used a lot of say like nitrogen applications that wind up producing a lot of nitrous oxide, which is a really potent greenhouse gas. Aside from policies that encourage that kind of grassroots local marketing, that we would also indirectly benefit from really good antitrust and enforcement of competitive markets because those really large meat processors like Smithfield or what have you, in a lot of ways, they act nefariously to kind of block smaller production. So you can encourage on one hand, and then if you have robust antitrust enforcement, protection of competitive markets at the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission, then you'd see the market open up to different scales of production on both sides, and that would give farmers more freedom to choose different methods of production. If farmers had more freedom to choose different methods of production, I think many would naturally be inclined to explore more climate smart practices because In a lot of ways, they save money on inputs and will have a better lifestyle. So we touched on intensively managed grazing, and I realized that there's some other climate smart practices we should probably talk about. And I did not organize the most logical way to bring them to you, but I'll just continue from talking about intensive grazing, and we'll talk about other practices that allow farmers to pursue benefits for the climate, as well as a more resilient food system in the face of changes from the climate that we can't avoid. A very popular practice that is kind of indicative of a greater trend is no-till farming. And along with no-till farming, you've got mulch-till, strip-till. The category of practices is called conservation tillage. And the reasons this is helpful is because you wind up needing, eventually you need less fertilizer because you've got really good soil health under soils you haven't disturbed too extensively. You make fewer passes in the field and burn less fuel to cultivate the soil, so that's good. You've got fossil fuel savings there on the farm. And the soil stays in place, stores carbon, and a secondary benefit there is water. There's a lot of interconnections between surface water quality and farming in a changing climate. So strip-till will help cope with that. You know, a lot of farmers' adverse decision when trying to cope with climate change is going to be to lay as much fertilizer as possible on the ground to help their crops cope with heat stress. That could not be worse in a lot of ways, because you'll have additional emissions of greenhouse gases into the air from extensive nitrogen applications, and the extreme rain events that we're witnessing more of are going to wash those fertilizers right into the water. You know, localized water quality problems like we saw in Des Moines, and then that contributes to the hypoxic zone downriver in the Gulf. So lots of problems with fertilizer and farming in a changing climate. Conservation tillage and other practices to prevent erosion like riparian buffers can do a lot to help us with that. Additionally, precision nutrient application is an important practice for a lot of farmers who are not going to be able to do without using fertilizer. It places the fertilizer directly into the soil rather than on top, so it stays in place and is more effectively available to plants. Precision nutrient application also involves very carefully monitoring the weather so that you're not applying any time around a rain event that could wash the fertilizer away. Applications of compost rather than commercial fertilizer, conventional fertilizer, synthetic fertilizer is really beneficial as well. Compost helps us cope with food waste in a climate smart way. You've got essentially fertilizer that has a very low carbon footprint. That's a really good practice for a lot of folks. And then we have some, I guess we'll lead into the Farm Bill discussion a little bit here, because the Farm Bill allows farmers, some of the Farm Bill programs allows farmers to set aside land that's not particularly productive, gets them an economic incentive to not burn up a lot of fertilizer, burn up a lot of cultivation on ground that isn't going to really actually produce an economic return. A lot of the practices that we talked about, conservation tillage or intensively managed grazing, are supported by the conservation title, Title II of the Farm Bill. We always need to protect funding for that and do what we can to make sure that those programs and the assistance that they afford are readily available to producers. We want, in particular, beginning farmers to be able to access those programs, because then you've got a lifelong commitment to climate smart farming in a lot of cases, if you can get someone more toward the beginning of their career. They'll also have, you know, retain tenure of the land longer, so you've ensured that land has a good steward on it for a longer amount of time. The commodity Title I, is really important, usually gets most of the conversation during the Farm Bill. Climate salient points there would be to increase access to crop insurance for farmers who are undergoing climate smart practices. A big climate smart practice that at the moment does not work particularly well with crop insurance is cover cropping. That's a practice where you plant something that doesn't produce a direct economic benefit, something that doesn't produce a crop you would harvest and sell for money. But it keeps the ground covered over winter, which is very important. It prevents erosion and just builds that soil health we want. And when you kill it or till it in, it adds nutrients into the soil that would otherwise need to be accommodated by synthetic application. That causes crop insurance adjusters to sometimes make an adverse judgment on a farmer on whether or not they can make a crop insurance claim. Farmers need crop insurance nowadays. It's not really smart to go without it, and that limits your access to farm lenders sometimes. So we really want to make sure that crop insurance doesn't disrupt people's ability to undertake cover crops and other conservation practices. The commodity title also does a lot to encourage that corn bean rotation. We'd want to open up, beneficial crop insurance schemes to just growing a more diverse, further extended crop rotation. The energy title is really big too. The energy title encourages renewable energy and energy efficiency on the farm. In a lot of cases, that's a really smart application because you're so remote that you can't really connect to the grid. So it's like a double win. In many cases, if we encourage that deployment, it's just going to become increasingly cost effective. There's a lot of folks that I know who work in rural solar power consulting companies, and they have found the support from the energy title of the Farm Bill really beneficial. It kind of got the ball rolling, and in a lot of these communities, they're not even utilizing the government support anymore because sufficient infrastructure was put in place, and then they're able to just kind of roll with it. I'll also touch briefly on the research title. The United States has a really proud history of really robust agriculture research at our land grants and through other means. That's a hard argument to make in the current fiscal climate. Folks don't want to see the government investing in things that don't have a really clear payoff. But the implications for agriculture resource and farming in a changing climate, farming in a way that mitigates climate change, are enormous. So we really want to see independent research, a variety of different means of research, and really robust research being protected and encouraged through the research title of the Farm Bill. I'd be happy to entertain questions at this time, if that works.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think for all of us, that was a pretty insightful description of the scene, talking with farmers and what they have to deal with. And thank you very much for that invitation, too, to post to work with you to figure out what we might want to post on your site. I think that would be fantastic.
Recording. Thank you, everybody, for joining. If people want to stay on, if Tom can stay on and answer questions, he's welcome to do that.